Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable Chief Justice David Gilbert presiding, is now in session.
Please be seated. Good morning. The first case for oral argument this morning is Lake Hendricks Improvement Association and others appellants versus Brookings County Planning and Zoning Commission and others appellees. For the appellants, we have Mr. Mitchell Peterson, an attorney from Sioux Falls. And for the appellees, we have Mr. Jack Heeb, an attorney from Aberdeen, and Mr. Brian Donahoe, an attorney from Sioux Falls. I understand, Mr. Heeb, you will be presenting first and speaking for 15 minutes, and then Mr. Donahoe will use the remaining five. Is that correct, gentlemen?
That's correct, Your Honor.
All right. Obviously, Justice Kern is not with us this morning. She was called away due to an illness in the family, but is listening over the Internet. Good morning, Justice Kern. And will be fully participating in the entire appellate process. With that, then, Mr. Peterson, you may proceed. Oh, one other thing, too. We are having problems with our lights. They don't work. And so I'll just orally tell you when you have 2 minutes left. And the digital clock is accurate. So with that, Mr. Peterson, you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court, the counsel. It's my pleasure to represent Norris Patrick, a landowner and taxpayer in Brookings County, the Lake Hendricks Improvement Association, which is a nonprofit corporation dedicated to the maintenance, safeguarding, and promotion of activities around Lake Hendricks, and also the city of Hendricks, Minnesota. The first issue in this case, at least the first one that appeared in our brief, is whether the board exceeded its jurisdiction and authority when it acted under ordinances which were not validly and legally adopted. The second issue has some sub-issues, and that's additionally whether the board exceeded its jurisdiction and authority by granting a conditional use permit for a dairy or a concentrated animal feeding operation, a CAFO, when the requirements of the ordinances were not met. And specifically, there are three requirements that were not met. Number one, there's a well within the half-mile setback. There's a lack of a road use agreement with the neighboring township, Oak Lake Township. And number three, the CAFO site sits atop a Zone B aquifer. All three of those situations do not permit the granting of a conditional use permit under the Brookings County ordinances. This does not involve a disagreement about how the circuit court weighed facts, how the board weighed facts. It involves facts that are not in dispute, and then applying those facts to the ordinances informed by this court's precedent. Specifically, this court has laid out in recent opinions and prior opinions the standard of review in a writ of certiorari appeal from a board of adjustment zoning decision or the grant of a conditional use permit. If the board has exceeded its jurisdiction, pursued its authority in an irregular manner, engaged in a forbidden act, neglected to do something that is required, if they have arbitrarily or willfully disregarded undisputed and indisputable proof, if they failed to contribute independent thought to the process, or if they failed to follow the guidelines of the ordinances, all of those situations warrant a reversal of the board's decision. The case law for that is 21-31-1, as well as Lamar, Armstrong, Hines, Safe Centennial Valley. It's all set forth in our brief. Additionally, to the extent this court needs to interpret the Brookings County ordinances to determine their meaning, that is done de novo under the City of Marion v. Rapp case. So there's no deference to how the Board of Adjustment is interpreting ordinances passed by a different county entity, the County Commission. As to the first issue, the Brookings County Commission in November of 2007 held two separate hearings at which the ordinances in question were discussed and ultimately adopted by the County Commission. The problem is there was no notice of either hearing.
Is that disputed?
That is not disputed.
Okay, so you're saying that this conditional use permit's null and void because the ordinance is void. That greatly concerns me, because what if you were going back and attacking the validity of an ordinance 50 years ago that was adopted? And what is the status of every other permit that was granted under that ordinance?
I had two responses to that. Number one, in the Pennington County versus Moore case, the fact that the ordinances were adopted 20 years in the past, this court said it doesn't matter what lapse of time is involved. But secondarily, this
Wait
court
a minute.
Can...
It doesn't matter. So what happens to it?
So what happens is, under our state statutes, if there's a zoning board decision, there's a 30-day window to appeal it.
Well, it's broader than that. I mean, any county doesn't do anything except by ordinance. So, I mean, you go back and attack the budget for 1966 because the ordinance wasn't valid then. I mean, where do we draw a line?
Well, I think those certainly are considerations, but the fact remains that's a Brookings County problem. They didn't publish notice.
It's going to be a problem for a lot more people, too, that thought they had valid permits and maybe got payments from the county. I mean, it sounds to me like a recipe for chaos.
Well, the court certainly could craft relief in a particular way in this case. Specifically, we are not seeking a declaration invalidating the ordinances or relief with respect to anything other than this particular conditional use permit. We are simply requesting that the board's decision be reversed and the permit be revoked.
Was the change in the ordinance, was that specifically limited to the conditional use permit? Isn't it that narrow? I mean, you aren't attacking the whole zoning process for Brookings County, are you?
I am simply stating that the ordinances under which the decision were made, which lay out the process, the procedure, that the board has authority to be reviewing conditional use permits, what the setbacks and requirements are, all of those. There's a comprehensive zoning change in 2007, and the county did not give notice of either hearing, and they didn't publish notice of adoption, which stripped the Brookings County residents of their right to referendum.
Well, did this change the whole zoning ordinances or just the conditional use permit provisions?
I haven't studied how it compares to the 1997 version, which also has problems with notice, but the conditional use permit process did change in 2007. The CAFA regulations with particular setbacks came in. The fact that a CAFO is a conditional use in a agricultural zone came in.
Well, your opponents have responded, okay, throw the ordinance out. That means since we own the land and there's no regulations, we can do what we darn well want to with it. What's your response?
The record does not support that. The record
in
does
what
not.
Way?
The record does not say what the ordinances are before. So what happens is they don't have a permit. So whatever the laws in Brookings County, Brookings has to figure out. So that would go back to the prior version of the ordinances that were last properly adopted and enacted. So it's not unzoned. It's not the Wild West. It's whatever there was there before. And I would state in particular, over the last 10 to 15 years, there's been a big push East River to adopt ordinances that allow for CAFOs and that lay out setbacks that are very similar from one county to the next. This court has seen a number of these appeals recently. They all look pretty similar because they're all part of the same process.
They also raise the issue that if you had a problem with the adoption of the Brookings County Ordinance, your proper legal remedy was under Chapter 7, and you only had 30 days to do that. What's your response to that?
I don't recall that particular statute being cited by the appellees. But
Chapter 7.
Chapter 7, I think... Chapter 7 governs appeals from a county commission or a
right.
county decision. I don't think that limits this court's ability to review the validity of ordinances. That is one remedy. A declaratory judgment action certainly would be another remedy. Additionally, I mean, this court in multiple different contexts has reviewed the validity of ordinances not under Chapter 7. In the Tibbs case, the Pennington County v. Moore case, which is part of enforcement of an ordinance against a salvage yard, in Dodds v. Bickle, and in the city of Brookings v. Martinson. Both of those were private cases where a party was suing to enjoin a particular activity by a neighbor because it was in violation of ordinances. This court reviewed the validity of the ordinances, found they were invalid, therefore no injunctive relief could be granted. In addition, in Save Centennial Valley, there was a review as well as part of a writ procedure. So our case law is filled with examples of reviewing the validity of ordinances in contexts other than a Chapter 7 appeal and other than a declaratory judgment action.
Do I understand your affidavit correctly? Apparently you went to the library and looked, is that right?
Yes.
And do I understand this to be the case that there was never notice given of the adoption either of the 2007? So someone wanting to challenge what happened in 2007, I don't know what the time period would be to start an appeal or a challenge. Is that right? There was no notice of the adoption as well as no notice of consideration.
That is correct. There was lacking a notice of the hearings before the hearings, and there was no notice or publication of adoption in the newspaper to give notice to the county that there's been a change, which thereby triggers referendum rights and possibly other rights under Chapter 7. Just, it didn't happen.
Did it show in the county commission minutes?
I'm sorry?
Did the adoption of the ordinance show in the county commission minutes?
Yes, it is reflected in the minutes of those meetings, but it was not published in the newspaper. And the statutes in particular...
Were the minutes published?
Presumably they were made available at the county zoning office, but there was no publication of that in the newspaper. And that our statutes, in this case, or in the Moore case, this court has held that there must be scrupulous compliance with the process of adopting ordinances. It's because it's so important, and there's so many rights and that ride on it that they have to be followed scrupulously. And here there was no publication in the newspaper, which is required under 11.221 and 11.230, which then triggers the referendum rights under 11.222.
As far as the record in front of us, you did this examination. Was this in front of the trial court? Is this disputed or not? When Mr. Heeb gets up, you anticipate that he will say, no, that's not disputed, that all of this was not done correctly?
I believe that will be the case. That's what it was at the trial court level. There's the dispute is whether or not the court can look at this. That's what the argument has been. It's not that plus, you know, we think we have evidence that it was done, that, you know, there's a page of the classified ads Mr. Peterson missed, and here's that page showing the notice. That's not the case.
So then why is it that you say that it can be looked at, the trial court could look at that issue?
Well, I think the first step, you know, in determining whether the board has exceeded its authority and jurisdiction is, well, what is the board's authority and jurisdiction? I mean, that is the elemental question. What authority does the board have? If the ordinances are not valid, they have no authority. Any act is beyond that authority if it doesn't exist.
Authority or jurisdiction?
Both.
All right, say you prevail. What relief are you seeking?
Reversal of the board's decision granting a conditional use permit to Killeskillen LLC.
So
with the permit revoked.
There's no permit at that point, and what happens then?
Then they have no permit, so they cannot proceed. They would need to apply for a new permit under whatever version of the ordinances are enacted. I would anticipate that Brookings County, following such a decision, may enact temporary zoning controls or enact new ordinances. Maybe just redo the same ordinances, but they have to go through that process. So whatever rules are in place, Killeskillen will need to abide by them.
So let's go back to the circuit court's rationale and how you respond to that. You know, it looked to me like the circuit court was saying, I only have jurisdiction to review the board, not whether the commission acted properly. And it is the commission that if there was a goof up, that's the goof up. So how do you respond to that? That certiorari only goes to review what the board did, not what the commission did.
Well, the certiorari review, again, the first question is, what authority does the board have? And in many cases, that might be reviewing the ordinances to find out, okay, they need a two-thirds vote. they've got to have a notice of a hearing 10 days in advance. Here are the substantive rules. They can't grant a permit in these conditions or that, so that the court often looks at what is the authority, and now let's look at whether the act has violated that.
But those were all acts of the board.
Yes, and in this case, the board has no authority and no jurisdiction because the ordinances are not valid. Any act it takes is not valid. Even if we didn't have the other issues on appeal, we didn't have the issue with the well and the aquifer and the road use agreement, their act is still beyond their jurisdiction and beyond their authority because the ordinances are invalid. I'll turn, unless there are other questions on the adoption of the ordinances, I'll spend a little time on some of the other issues. In particular, the well issue. There's a well setback. There cannot be a private well off-site that's within a half mile or 2,640 feet. It's undisputed that the Killiskillen engineers submitted a report from a state registry of wells that did not show a well anywhere within the setback. In reality, there is no dispute. There is a well within 2,640 feet.
Hey, is there a notice requirement? Was notice given so that the landowners within that area would have known that this was pending and could protect their well?
There's an affidavit from Mr. Snodgrass on whose property this well resides. We are not disputing that notice was mailed. There's an affidavit from the county official, proof of the mailing. It went out. That's not a basis for our appeal, a lack of notice. But in reality, Mr. Snodgrass didn't get notice because he was residing in Alaska at the time. So he didn't actually receive the notice that would have alerted him to go say something about his well. And that's set forth in his affidavit.
Under the ordinance, can Mr. Snodgrass waive this protection? Or is it mandatory if you got a well within X number of feet, you can't get the conditional use permit, period?
To be frank and say, I don't know. I don't recall there being a written waiver process. There might be, but a waiver needs to be clear and explicit. That wasn't the case here. His affidavit makes clear he's not waiving that right.
But he did not object either.
He did not object at the hearing before the board. He was not even there. That is correct.
Well, are you saying the board had a duty to go out and independently investigate
yes.
the existence of wells? Well, how can that square with our cases that have pulled up short agencies that, when exercising quasi-judicial authority, are out doing their own independent investigation? I mean, granting one of these permits, it's got to be quasi-judicial. A quasi-judicial function, and how could they, without violating ex parte and rules like that, go out and independently do their own investigation? I can see it in a legislative act by a board or a commission or something, but in the quasi-judicial context, it just seems odd.
Well, I think ex parte interviews would be entirely inappropriate, and Armstrong v. Turner County, this court made that clear. But I don't think that means the board looks so narrowly at just the information being fed to it by the interested party, the applicant, that a board needs to have its blinders off a little bit. And I think Hines makes that clear, that you can't just accept what one side says. There's a broader duty to ensure that the ordinances are met. And the ordinances say that there's a duty on the board to certify in writing that there's compliance with the ordinances. Board didn't even look at the property. It's got a 20-foot tower above the well. It's right next to the CAFO site. It can't be missed.
But, in Hines, the board just ignored the statute. And just the neighbors didn't like it, so they went, that's different. I just haven't seen any authority that would require any kind of independent investigation in a quasi-judicial inquiry.
Well, certainly it would be expressly a new holding of this court, but I think it'd be within certainly the spirit of Hines that there needs to be independent thought that comes to the process. And I think the notion of independence means looking at everything that needs to be looked at. And maybe there's a line.
That's,
Thank you. And maybe there's a line to be drawn on what substantial compliance, what the minimum is, but here they did nothing.
Well, except they did have an engineering report that said there wasn't a well there. I mean, it may have been wrong, but they did have that in front of them, did they not, when they acted?
I believe the information from the engineers was the database, the state registry indicated no wells, but that is far from all-inclusive. It's just whoever's got a well registered on the state registry, but that doesn't answer the question of whether there's other wells out there. And I think the board, at a minimum, if they're not going to get in a pickup truck and drive out there, ask the engineer to say, okay, we see there's a well report, but have you actually surveyed the property? Have you walked around? Are there any other wells or any other items that are within the list of setbacks that are going to be problematic? And then the board can figure out, well, is it a well or isn't it? Is there a basis for a variance? And that's a whole separate process. But at a minimum, the board needs to realize what is in front of it and ask the right questions to determine that there is compliance. And they just didn't do that here. The last thing I want to touch on is the aquifer. The ordinances make absolutely clear that a CAFO cannot be on a Zone B aquifer. It is in this case. There are structures, the actual building where the confinement will take place, that is not literally on top of the Zone B aquifer. But a CAFO, according to the ordinances, is defined to include also the lot, the yard, the corral, building, or other area. That certainly would include things beyond the physical structures. It's a straightforward violation of the ordinances that this CAFO has a permit above an aquifer.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Mr. Heave, you have 15 minutes, sir.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. I want to address a couple of things that came up in argument at the offshoot. I don't believe that the, what I'll call the merits of whether the 2007 ordinance or the 1997 ordinance were properly noticed or published were decided by Judge Foley. Judge Foley went directly to the issue of whether he had authority to make those determinations and never made it. So with respect to that question that came up, I don't think it's fair to say that Judge Foley was given the opportunity to pass on the validity of those ordinances. The matter was fully briefed, much of which is what you see in the record. He simply showed up and said, in his decision said, I'm not going there because I don't think I have the authority to do so.
Do you concede that the 2007 ordinances were never properly adopted because of lack of publication?
What? I don't know the answer to that, because what I've got or what we've got is Mr. Peterson's affidavit regarding his research at the library. Have we uncovered evidence of publication that would refute that? No, I've got nothing in the record that I could provide to the court to suggest that. Would that be something that we would dispute if we were going back down to have that battle, or if we were going to have that battle in what we would consider to be an appropriate proceeding over the validity of those ordinances? I don't know the answer to that. We don't have anything in the record, certainly, to refute what Mr. Peterson has put into the record to advance his argument. Our position on it is similar to what you see in the brief, which is that it's less than clear what Mr. Peterson suggests when he says that, well, if you kick out the 2007 ordinance and you kick out the 97 ordinance, well, then there's this other ordinance back there that would likely take effect that would probably prohibit Mr. Donahue's client from building what they want to build. And this is where Mr. Donahue and I may be sitting at the same table, but trust me, we represent different interests, because Mr. Donahue's client would benefit greatly, greatly from a situation where there was no zoning regulation in Brookings County. And the point is obvious. The court has already mentioned it this morning. There are many counties in South Dakota, and I grew up in a time when there was no zoning. You could do whatever you wanted to do. You could build it as big as you wanted to build it. Those days are gone in most counties, including Brookings County. And my suggestion would be on behalf of the people of Brookings County and on behalf of my client, which is the planning board, we don't want the baby thrown out with the bathwater here, because it would result in a situation where people could build the dairy as big as they wanted to, wherever they wanted to. And the suggestion that was made that, well, the county would probably adopt some sort of an emergency zoning plan, I think that's all speculation, and there's nothing in the record to support that. The thing that I want to suggest to the court is that there really isn't, and I think it makes sense, when you look at the cases that Mr. Peterson has cited, half of the cases he cites where he says the validity of the ordinance has been routinely questioned by this court, those are cases where the body who is trying to enforce the ordinance is trying to use it against an individual to keep them from doing something on their land. And that individual, in defense of that action, is saying to the court, wait a minute, you can't stop me under that ordinance. That ordinance doesn't even validly exist. That is a far cry from the inverse, which is what we're seeing here, where we have a very narrow review of what the trial court is tasked with looking at this under a writ of cert review. And the court knows what the standard is there. And instead of going at even the evidence, which clearly this court has said you can't do, they're going a step beyond that. And they're going and attacking the actual ordinance under some idea that, well, if we can't get where we want to go here, we're going to try to get there by going over here. And the result is, honestly, chaos. I mean, that is what you will have. And I take the...
Well,
yes.
The solution to that is pass the ordinance right in the first place, is it not?
I don't disagree with that, Your Honor. In situations where you have that type of a defect, that may be true. But I would suggest for you that as we go along, you're putting the governmental body in a position of having to disprove a negative. In other words, if you can't go and find, whether it's because the courthouse burned, or whether it's because the newspaper office burned, or whether it's because somebody did a poor job of archiving, or whether it's because the records are lost, if you go back far enough, what the test here seems to be is, if we can't find it, well, then it must not have happened, or it must not have existed, or nobody must have known about it. And I think the opposite is true with respect to this situation. The unfairness that Mr. Peterson talks about simply doesn't exist here. Everybody, there's no evidence that people in Brookings County didn't know that they had zoning ordinances or didn't know that those zoning ordinances have been in place and been amended. They were clearly there to exercise their rights under those ordinances.
Is there anything in the record to back up your observation where a person comes in and says, I would have objected if I'd known, but I didn't know because the ordinances were never properly adopted? Is there anything like that in the record?
No.
Somebody can cry foul.
No. No, there is nobody that has come forward and said, you know, had I known this or had I known that, the landscape would have looked differently. This is, in all candor, purely some sort of a gotcha argument. And
well, yeah, but is that... We have to look at what our remedy is, or what your remedy is. Mm-hmm. If we decide that cert is the appropriate method of determining whether or not the ordinances were appropriately passed, that's would have been an appropriate issue before the trial court, then what do you say our next step would be? Send it back to the trial court and have a hearing on it?
I think at a minimum,
answer those questions that you just raised.
Sure. I think at a minimum, Your Honor, if I understand the question correctly, in this case, yes, that would be the appropriate remedy. You'd have to send it back to the trial court and at least give Judge Foley an opportunity to develop a record with respect to whether these ordinances were properly passed or not. Now, I will take it a step further, and I'm going to apologize to Mr. Donahue for stepping on his toes here, but I think there are two things that call into question, in addition to what's already been mentioned, the idea that using the writ of cert standard in an appellate review of a board's decision, whether that's appropriate. And the first one is, in Section 65, not only does the legislature, in Section 61 and 62, specifically talk about the standard of review. In 65, they lay out an exhaustive list of remedies available to the trial court. So hypothetically, Your Honor, even if we send this back to Judge Foley and he decides statutes were improperly or ordinances were improperly enacted, they're not valid. The question then becomes, well, what then is the remedy? Because his remedy statutorily is one of three things. He can either affirm, he can reverse, or he can modify. Well, there's nothing to modify. We've now got a determination that the ordinance itself is invalid. You can't modify a permit under an invalid ordinance. You can't reverse a decision under an ordinance that doesn't exist. And so I think that even the legislative scheme suggests that that's not something that the legislature anticipated being part of this process. The thing that when we're talking about that, and I want to touch on a couple of other issues, so I'm going to jump over to the well because there were things said about the well that I want to talk about. The Snodgrass affidavit that Mr. Peterson talks about was rejected. There's absolutely no evidence there was a functioning well there at any time. The only evidence of a well, frankly, came from Mr. Peterson's own statements in the transcript to the trial court, which he has now cited to this court. So I want to make sure we understand it's not undisputed that there was a well there as that term was defined under the ordinance. Once again, something that I think would need to be fleshed out if we were going to go there, because Judge Foley said, I'm not going there. I'm not going to consider that affidavit or that evidence that's in it. More importantly, with respect to that well, what this court said in Grant County, which I think applies equally here, even if you look at the Snodgrass affidavit, which is in the record, all it says is, I have a well. It doesn't say I'm going to be negatively impacted as a result of the CAFO. I'm going to lose my ability to water my cattle. I'm going to lose my ability to do something that I need my well for. Now, this is where I'm going to apologize to Mr. Donahue for stepping on his toes to some degree, but that's the type of particularized injury that gets you standing, you know, potentially. As somebody who's particularly affected as a result of this. And this goes to what you were saying about if we're going to send this back, the question I would have for the court on the issue of whether you can consider the validity of the ordinances in the context of this, where is the standing at that point if that's going to be the issue? I mean, how is it that somebody can show that particularized injury in this situation? We haven't got a single person, as you have pointed out, who's come forward and said, I would have done things differently, or I've been harmed as a result of this.
Did the Snodgrass affidavit, after he acknowledged he had a will, say, I object, or anything?
I don't remember if it said, I object. It was simply about five paragraphs, and he simply said, I want to point out I have a well on my property. He might have used the word I object. I don't recall, Your Honor.
Right.
I read it last night, but I remember him saying, all he said was, I have a well. He didn't tell this court or the lower court how the existence of that well provided some sort of a particularized injury to him as it related to the existence of the CAFO, which once again, I'm stepping on Mr. Donahue's toes, and I won't do it any longer. I'll move on to the aquifer issue. The aquifer issue, once again, and the court may have picked up on this, Mr. Peterson says it's undisputed that this sits on top of an aquifer. It's not undisputed. It depends upon how you define this. What Mr. Donahue's client did was purchase unplatted land. There's a quarter of ground. It's the smallest piece of ground without platting it that you could have a legal description for. As the court saw, there was a lot of evidence and a lot of testimony in front of the board from engineers who did well boring, who looked at those maps. And it was considered in the context of where is the CAFO going to be located on this quarter of ground? And the plans and all of the testimony talk about it being up in the northeast corner of the quarter, which means it is not on top of the aquifer, which means all of the soil boring indicated no aquifer was present. What Mr. Peterson is saying when he says it's undisputed that this was sited on top of an aquifer is that the legal description described in the property owned by Mr. Donahue's client, part of that legal description sits on top of the aquifer.
Is the conditional use permit restricted to the site where the buildings are, whatever, or does it refer to the whole property that's owned?
2 minutes.
Your Honor, I believe it is restricted in the sense that the plans that were provided to the board show the locations of where things are going to go. And this is what Judge Foley centered on when he talked about both this and the road use.
Okay. My question is, without going back to the Board of Adjustments, could the owner or operator move the actual location to another location because of the wording of the permit?
I don't believe so. And in fact, they couldn't get the building permit to build it. That was the point that Judge Foley made also. There are additional steps required, and those steps have to be taken in conjunction with the permit. So in other words, if they're going to have to go and pull building permits to build these structures. And if their sites under the building permit don't match what they're zoned for, they're not going to get the permits. Or Mr. Peterson's client or someone else can certainly come to the court or come back to the board and say, wait a minute, they're not doing what they said they were going to do. Stop them. Which was the point that Judge Foley made also with respect to the road use agreements, and we've seen it with manure management plans, we've seen it with nutrient management plans. The board has continuing jurisdiction. But to answer your question, I don't believe they could. I don't believe they could move this site, in a direct answer to your question, from the northeast corner of that property down to the southwest corner of that property and say, hey, we've got a permit. I don't believe they could do that. That would be a material deviation from what they gave the board and how they got their permit, and that would be shut down if the board was doing its job, which we assume they will do. I'm out of time. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Heeb. Mr. Donahoe, you have 5 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel, and co-counsel. I rise to briefly address the issue of subject matter jurisdiction and standing. And I understand those are separate concepts, but in this particular case where we have an appeal of a quasi-judicial determination by a board of adjustment, the standing as a constitutional matter does become jurisdictional. We are arguing and we have presented cases to establish that this particular issue is dispositive and should have been decided differently by Judge Foley at the circuit trial level. The issue here is whether or not there has been a showing by any of the petitioners that they have a concrete or particularized injury that is different in kind from those of the general public. Clearly, they do not. In regard to this well issue, I want to briefly address that and make sure that we're clear on one of the facts that I think may have been mistakenly addressed with the oral argument by my opposing counsel. This was not a failure by the Board of Adjustment to go out and take a look at the site. In fact, they have photographs that were presented to the board by staff at the hearing. And there's no obvious well in those pictures. We're talking about an old abandoned rotary-type windmill stand. It's not listed on the county or the state registry as a well. And I raise that as an issue because that's a perfect example of why we don't have standing on any of these petitioners here. Mr. Snodgrass is not saying, I've got a concrete particularized injury because I can't use my well if this dairy is built. All of the other people live far away and have no specific interest in this other than the general speculative arguments that they raised as to environmental issues in general. They say that big dairies are bad, there could be a spill. In the case of Lake Hendricks, there's another lake, Oak Lake, in between on that watershed before it would ever get to their lake. And Hendricks, Minnesota is not a municipality that has any standing to bring the claims that they have in this court, where we have a statutory jurisdictional scheme under our legislature's plan in which you have joint jurisdiction within 3 miles of city limits, and then there's no jurisdiction beyond that.
What about the disjunctive statute and the taxpayer argument? For whatever reason, the legislature wrote it that way.
And it has not been correct.
And Article 5, Section 5 of the Constitution gives the legislature exclusive power to determine appellate jurisdiction of the courts. And that's the way they did it. They said or.
I understand that, Your Honor. When we've presented an argument in regard to how that can be interpreted other than the disjunctive, I do just want to make sure that we all understand that that statute has now been amended, and as of July 1st, the legislature has made it very clear what they always intended, I think, which is that it has to be an aggrieved taxpayer, consistent with the requirements under the ordinance, or excuse me, under the statutes allowing an appeal from a county commission.
Minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. So in regard to that, the simple answer is, whether it's or not, you still have to meet the constitutional standing requirement. Just because you're a taxpayer doesn't mean that you can then assume that that statute gives you the concrete and particularized injury. As a matter of constitutional law, standing is what is preventing the courts from stepping into an area that should be decided on the political level. Here it's because we have statutes that allow the county to make these ordinances and specify the criteria for a conditional use.
Would they have standing to address the question of whether or not the ordinances were appropriately adopted?
That's an excellent question, Your Honor. And Justice Severson, I'm going to tell you, they don't in this situation because of the fact that they are arguing that there would be this comprehensive overhaul of the zoning ordinance, which is invalid, and that ordinance is the one that requires that you get a conditional use permit for our type of operation. Therefore, there is no zoning that would require us to get this permit. In other words, they don't have any injury because if you wipe out these ordinances, we can go build what we want without the permit. And therefore, they're arguing for a procedural error which gives them no harm because the end result would be we can do what we want. And in fact, if the court were to decide that this should go back down to the trial court for a hearing on that issue, what my client would probably need to do in the absence of a stay would go build and then be grandfathered in. So it really is ridiculous for them to get up here and argue about that issue. And unless you have further questions, my time is out and I would be finished.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Donahoe.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Mr. Peterson, you have 10 minutes for rebuttal.
Well, certainly a lot of issues have been brought up. I'll kind of march through some of them, unless there's anything in particular the court would like addressed. Mr. Ebe argues that Judge Foley never made a determination on whether the ordinances were valid, but when pressed, Mr. Ebe readily acknowledges there is nothing in the record that suggests the notices were ever published, either notice of the hearing before the ordinances were adopted or notice of the adoption. If you look at my affidavit, it has the public notice provision from the Brookings County Register from many, many weeks on either side of the critical events. It establishes a pattern of when they do publish notice. They just didn't do it, and they've presented absolutely no evidence. At a minimum, this court should remand, but I think it could be decided based on the undisputed record at this point that there was not notice.
Refresh my memory. Was this decided on summary judgment? Where there would have been some obligation for the other side to refute your affidavit? Or was it a matter of law? How did Judge Foley, I forgot how he actually handled it procedurally.
Well, procedurally, the circuit court didn't make a determination because the circuit court just said, this is beyond beyond what a circuit court can look at.
So it wasn't summary judgment?
It was not.
Okay.
But certainly that this court could review the record de novo, and it's readily apparent the ordinances were not adopted correctly. They are invalid. Regarding the issue of whether it's zoned or unzoned and what's the aftermath, well, the immediate aftermath is Killiskillen does not have a permit. And they would have to comply with whatever rules are in place. That would include whatever's there now or whatever came before the 2007. Or anything the county does between now and whenever Killiskillen decides to take action. It's a Brookings County issue. They'll need to decide how to deal with that. Mr. Heap suggests that, when this court has considered the validity of ordinances in other contexts, it's almost always an enforcement action. And that's true in the Pennington County v. Moore case and in the city of Brookings case. But in Tibbs, it wasn't. This court very recently in an exact kind of appeal, a CAFO conditional use permit, the argument was raised by myself on behalf of my client that the ordinances in Moody County were not adopted correctly because the county didn't follow a two-step procedure. I suggested Planning Commission needs to have a hearing and there needs to be a separate hearing from the County Commission. This court disagreed and said that can happen at the same time as long as there's notice of both hearings. Therefore, the ordinances were valid in Moody County. As this court is well aware, any jurisdictional issues are to be raised sua sponte by this court. There was no indication by this court that that sort of review in Tibbs was beyond what a circuit court or the Supreme Court should look at. Additionally, in the Dodds case and Save Centennial Valley case, those are two other situations in which the validity of the ordinances were examined by this court that are not enforcement actions, as Mr. Heeb argues. I want to touch on, too, this issue of timing of, you know, why, you know, why action wasn't taken earlier, why didn't the invalidity of the ordinances, why wasn't this raised years ago? And I don't think that it matters. And in the Moore case, again, that case involved invalid ordinances that were not properly adopted by Pennington County, like, you know, roughly 20 years before the enforcement action. And this court wrote, the validity of this ordinance was not a matter of concern to the Moores until such time as it affected their legal rights. When it did so affect them, they properly placed the validity of the ordinances in issue. That's exactly what is going on in this case. The validity of the ordinances is affecting the rights of my clients, and that's why it's being asserted now. This court has observed that that is appropriate to raise at that point in time. It doesn't need to be done, you know, immediately after the ordinances are adopted improperly. Regarding the Snodgrass affidavit, the court asked whether, you know, did Mr. Snodgrass actually object, or did he just say, I have a well? Paragraph 4 of his affidavit states that had I been notified of the proposed CAFO and public hearing, I would have voiced my opposition thereto. So paragraph 4 indicates Darrell Snodgrass is opposed to this. He would have voiced his opposition, but he was living in Alaska and didn't get the notice. It's unfortunate, but that is the reality.
Is that the county's fault he was in Alaska and didn't get the notice?
It is not. It is merely an explanation of why Mr. Snodgrass wasn't at the hearing. Again, we're not arguing that, that is a reason for reversal in and of itself, that he didn't get the letter. It's just offered as explanation. You know, this issue of the aquifer is important. The ordinances define what a CAFO is. And in particular, the ordinances are what need to be looked at. Mr. Heeb has some arguments about, well, is the CAFO, is it just the building? Is it everything? They can't just move it. The ordinances really answer this question pretty clearly, and this court can review what those ordinances mean under a de novo standard of review. And a CAFO is defined to include the lot, the yard, the corral, the building, and other areas. There's a separate definition in the record of an animal feeding operation structure, and that's defined to include an anaerobic lagoon, a form manure storage structure, egg washwater storage structure, earth and manure storage basin, or a confinement building. So Brookings County identified there are CAFO or animal feeding operation structures, but when it defined CAFO, it included those structures plus some other stuff that is defined as a CAFO. And that's because the CAFO isn't confined just to the building. There are animals going in and out. There's manure. There's stormwater. There's wastewater that washes out. There's feed piled up with leachate that leaches down through. It washes all over the place. There's dead carcasses of cattle that need to be piled up. The operation of the CAFO doesn't stay within the nice confines of the building. It goes beyond that, and that's what the county recognized when it defined a CAFO. And when it said, you can't have one of these things above an aquifer, it is too much of a risk. It's too much of a risk because it can pollute groundwater. And that's why those protections were put in place. In fact, the ordinances at the record, page A89, states that the aquifer is being protected because it is a valuable natural resource. Number 2, provides drinking water. Number 3, contamination is not justified, even though it may not be a public water supply. And number 4, contaminants in his own aquifer could eventually reach his own aquifer. So that tells us what the county was thinking when it said, we don't want CAFOs ever. There's no exception to it. It cannot be on top of an aquifer. It is too great of a risk. The board here stepped beyond its jurisdiction. There's no situation in which a board of adjustment in Brookings County can grant a CAFO permit if there's a Zone B or Zone A aquifer. It's undisputed that that is located on the permit. The permit is for the entire property. The CAFO is on the entire property. Finally, on the issue of standing, I think Mr. Donahue's comment is in some ways an admission that the legislature fixed what was quite readily a problem with, thank you, Your Honor, with 11261. It is written in the disjunctive. It quite clearly states that any person jointly or severally aggrieved, comma, or any taxpayer, comma, or any county official. If the word aggrieved was supposed to apply to all of those, why would a county official have to be aggrieved? How would a county official be aggrieved? If a county official wants to appeal a decision, they've got the statutory right to do it. Our legislature, they might have meant something else, but their language is clear, and that is how intent must be examined, is from the actual language used by the legislature. Maybe they meant for anyone to be aggrieved, or maybe they've just changed their mind in a different political climate. But the fact remains that under 11261, any taxpayer has standing to file an appeal. Norris Patrick is a taxpayer. That's undisputed. He has standing, and under the Military Toxics Project, if one has standing, all have standing as long as the same remedy is being sought. Additionally, I'd rely on our brief as to arguments for the aggrieved party status, but, you know, Lake Hendricks Improvement Association and the City of Hendricks depend on this water supply that is nearby the CAFO. They are concerned about pollution. They are concerned about odor, noise, traffic on the roads with trucks going in and out. Those are all things that place it at risk, its natural resource at risk. It certainly has standing, the minimal standing to assert this. But more importantly, I don't believe standing is a jurisdictional issue. It's not an issue of subject matter jurisdiction. The subject matter of this litigation is the appeal. Who can do it is a separate issue. It's not jurisdictional. It is waivable, according to our brief. And in this case, Killis-Gillen failed to properly notice review of this issue. They did not serve all parties on appeal. Therefore, the issue has been waived.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Court will be in recess for 10 minutes.